Today on the 21st Show, a new novel explores racism, feminism, and history through the eyes of a Portuguese immigrant and many others who made their homes in Springfield in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The book is called The House of Lincoln, and the author is Nancy Horan. She was born and raised in Springfield. We'll talk about the book and take your questions. I'm Brian Mackey in conversation with Nancy Horan for the hour today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. When you read through history books, specifically stories of the people and events that left significant marks on the world, it's easy to lose sight of the bigger picture. While Abraham Lincoln was on a path to become the 16th president of the United States, many people in Springfield knew him above all else as an honest man with a good sense of humor. While Frederick Douglass was fiercely advocating against slavery, many black people in Illinois were just trying to live their lives. And while what went on to become known as the Springfield race riots were playing out in real time, many more people were looking on, reading the headlines from the daily paper, and idly watching their gardens grow, even as the chaos continued. While history is taking its course, many more people, those whom you don't read about in history books, are participants in history, even if they don't realize it at the time. A new historical novel is called The House of Lincoln, and it aims to shed some light on that. It explores decades of history, from the years before the Civil War into the early 20th century, through the eyes of a woman named Anna, whose Portuguese family comes to Springfield to escape persecution and find opportunity. Many other people come and go, in and out of Springfield, and in and out of Anna's life. The book's author, Nancy Horan, was herself born and raised in Springfield. Horan previously wrote Loving Frank and Under the Wide and Starry Skies, both of which became New York Times bestsellers. Before becoming a novelist, she worked in Chicago as a journalist, and Horan now lives in the Puget Sound area in Washington State. The House of Lincoln is out now from the publisher Sourcebooks Landmark, and its author joins us now. Nancy Horan, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Listeners, as ever, you're welcome to join our conversation by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about the book for our entire show today. What did you learn or not learn in school about racism in Illinois, for example? That's going to come up later in our conversation. Maybe you've even read The House of Lincoln or Loving Frank or one of Horan's other books. What do you want to know about writing a historical novel? 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right. I want to begin with this idea we were just talking about a moment ago, because it's something your main character, Anna, in particular, reckons with as the book goes on. How much do you think people realize, as they are living through history, that they are living through something that's going to be significant in retrospect?
I think that's such an interesting question. I think in the case of Anna and the other people in the book whose points of view are part of the book, they have their own personal immediate issues top of mind. Anna was from a family of refugees, religious exiles from the island of Madeira, a possession of Portugal. And they arrived after having been through great turmoil, and they were coming to America to establish a safe life and a free life. And they had great hopes and desires, but they were poor. They had lived for a year in Trinidad working in sugar fields and were suffering from the climate and just the change from their previous home. So When they arrived in Illinois, again, Portuguese immigrants were quite unusual in the Midwest. But a group of some 300 or more refugees arrived, and they were split up into two groups between Jacksonville and Springfield, Illinois. And like most, they really are representative of so many immigrants coming to the United States. They're working to get bread on the table. They're trying to learn the language. These are the things that they're struggling with. So to find themselves in a situation where the place they have taken refuge is in the midst of a growing national crisis related to slavery was something they hadn't bargained on, undoubtedly. And so how much were they aware of that? I think their first concerns were simply a roof over their head and food and jobs and that sort of thing, and getting established. But this growing crisis just was going to affect them tremendously. They didn't know it, and it happened slowly and gradually, and Anna sees evidence of the problems of slavery in Springfield at the time when she observes slave hunters there. So, you know, did she realize, did they realize that they were in the midst of something big? Probably not until they had to send a child to war, a first-generation child. And that's not a unique American experience. I mean, it happened a lot in America where first-generation immigrants ultimately served in wars. So I think what you're asking is, you know, are we aware now, perhaps, that we are in a critical moment in history? Some people would say very definitely yes, and other people perhaps are completely oblivious to any threat of whatever crisis is in the headlines.
Yeah, and what we probably, even those of us who are aware, maybe disagree on what the nature of that threat and crisis might be. But that's maybe a conversation for another day. The book is called The House of Lincoln, and I want to talk a little about Illinois' most famous citizen, Springfield's most famous citizen, certainly. He's one of the main characters in this book. But, you know, we see this different side of him, right? There's this mythology built up, huge monuments here in Springfield, in Washington, of course. Mm-hmm. But here we see him as a human being with his family, making conversation with people coming and going from his home. Talk about portraying that version of Lincoln.
Yeah, I wanted to look at the people around Lincoln. This is so many books, something like 15,000 books have been written about Abraham Lincoln. I wanted
it's him and Churchill, right?
Thought,
they're the two and Jesus, I suppose. Yes.
Exactly, and Jesus. So, you know, I had moments when I thought, "Are you crazy?" But I was drawn to learn about the community of Lincoln. Who were they? How did they shape him? When he left Springfield, it broke his heart to leave those people. He said, "You made me who I am." Who were those people who came to admire and respect, you know, an ill-dressed, friendly country lawyer and helped shape him into a person who became the most popular president in history? I mean, regularly he's regarded as the best president in history. You know, he had 1 year of formal schooling. What was it about that community that gave him the confidence and experience to basically take on that work and have the courage to take on the issue of slavery? So I think that it was sort of a mutual experience. I was looking at what those people gave to him, what he saw in them, and what he gave to them, and their destinies were intertwined, as it turned out, because Lincoln did become president and was a war president. You know, he was at the helm during just one of the, well, really the worst war in American history in terms of the death toll. I read that, you know, the numbers of people who died in the Civil War are estimated as, some say 620,000, as recently as 750,000. But if you combined the death toll of every war that the U.S. was engaged in, starting with the Revolutionary War, working all the way up through World War I, World War II, and the Korean War, only then would you begin to combine all those numbers of dead and equal the number of Americans who died in the Civil War. It was cataclysmic. It was disastrous. It was savage. And these people lived through that. And ultimately, in the North, they supported Lincoln. Not unanimously. I mean, much of what I learned was a discovery that my original images of the Midwest as northern states who were fully on Lincoln's side was much more complicated than that. But I think that I wanted to know about the common people because Lincoln was one of those people. I wanted to know about the times and places and experiences of these folks.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Nancy Horan, the author. Her novel is called The House of Lincoln. It is about a woman named Anna, an immigrant to Illinois and Springfield in the time before, through the Civil War, and into the early 20th century.
I'd like to tell you just something about the title. The title is a little confusing to some people because they approach the book expecting it to be maybe an upstairs-downstairs sort of book where you see through the servant's perspective what Lincoln's life was like. There's part of that in there, but it is not like other Lincoln books in the sense that it is as much about the community as it is about that house at 8th and Jackson Street. It's more about Lincoln's world in Springfield.
Sure.
And in that sense, the House of Lincoln, the title really takes in that whole world.
Well, talk about that. How true to history do you intend this novel to be? How do you strike that balance?
Well, that's always tricky for historical novelists, but my own particular approach is that I stick with the historical record. I don't have any interest in departing from the real facts because and the agreed-upon facts, but I do tend to draw my own conclusions in the end about the characters and so forth. But I find the history itself is so extraordinary. I don't feel the need to invent incidents unless they enlarge and enhance the story, perhaps where there's missing information. But I start with the chronology, in this case, of events that happened, and then I tell the story from different viewpoints as those events occur, so that by the end, you have pieced together that world and how people experienced it all the way through. And so there is chronology based upon history, based upon facts. But often there is not enough information about a character. So there are three points of view that are represented in the book. One is Mary Lincoln's point of view. She's as inside as you can get, you know. She's and we know a lot about Mary. There's a lot of information available for her. Again, I drew my own conclusions. There's the fictional character of Anna Ferreira. She is invented because I did not identify a particular person I wanted to follow from that group of Portuguese immigrants in Springfield. But the experiences that Anna has, her background, is all based upon historical information. And finally, there's a third point of view, and that is the point of view of Spencer Donegan. Spencer Donegan is a free black man whose family migrated from Kentucky to Springfield. A large family whose mother, Leanna Donegan, brought that family to Springfield, moved with them. They were present in Springfield, and they were a wonderful discovery to find that there was a very active, politically, quietly active Underground Railroad members' family in Springfield, and that was the Donegans. And the Donegan name came up in historical records in several ways. So when I wanted to explore Spencer Donegan, who would tell some of the story, I wanted to know more about him, and it was hard to find information. I knew he was occasionally Lincoln's barber. He was a partner in a barber shop with William Florville, who was a very close friend of Lincoln's. At that time, black barbers sometimes served exclusively white clientele, and that was the case in that barber shop. He was also a minister, and he started the first AME church in Springfield. So he was obviously a spiritual man. What I learned is that he was also an activist in a different sense from his brother, William. William was an Underground Railroad conductor, which was discovered in the 20th century. Somebody, a librarian, pieced together an anonymous narrator of a tale that appeared in a historical magazine, and it turned out to be William Donegan.
Interesting. You know, I'm going to ask you to pause there. We need to take a break, and we're going to come back to this conversation. William Donegan, for those who know Springfield history well, is a name that will be familiar, and we're going to talk about that as we continue our conversation with Nancy Horan, who is the author of the new historical novel, The House of Lincoln. It's out now. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Please stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our conversation with Nancy Horan, who's the author of the historical novel, The House of Lincoln. Horan's previous books include Loving Frank and Under the Wide and Starry Skies. She was herself born and raised in Springfield. Before she became a novelist, she worked in Chicago as a journalist. She's now living in Washington State, and she's joining us for the hour today. If you want to join our conversation, 800-222-9455 is the number to call. 800-222-9455. And I'm sorry I had to interrupt you. We are on a fixed clock on our program, but you were talking about William Donegan and sort of inventing the idea of inventing historical novels, and what are some of the, you know, how true to history you intend your writing to be?
And so I was just to finish the last thought. Yes, I do stick with the historical facts as much as possible and do tons of research. So when I chose Spencer Donegan to tell the part of the story from a black point of view, I learned that he was a member of a movement in the United States called, at that time, the Colored Convention Movement. And he really was an activist in that respect, in fighting the black laws that existed in Illinois. So he and his brother, William, who was an Underground Railroad conductor, were both activists. And I think the whole family was very engaged in fighting the black laws that existed in Illinois at that time.
So there are other big picture ideas in the book we can get to a little later, but I do want to talk about Illinois' role writ large, right? There's a line from a review of your book in the Illinois Times, Springfield's alt-weekly newspaper. It's actually the review that put your book on our radar, and the reviewer basically said, yes, the Lincolns are a significant part of the story, but if you go bigger picture, the city of Springfield itself could be considered the main character. I wonder what you think of that.
Mm-hmm. I think it is in an interesting way. It was a microcosm of the Midwest and the state of Illinois. It had so many different kinds of people in it. Lincoln's neighborhood, where he lived and with Mary, was by contemporary standards a very diverse neighborhood. There was a scholar in Springfield, Richard Hart, who was a wonderful researcher, and he's an attorney in Springfield, and his great interest was in finding out about the people around the Lincolns. And there were all kinds of people living together in that neighborhood. So it was, in a sense, a microcosm. And it was also, it ultimately became a microcosm for the United States itself, particularly when Lincoln began to debate Stephen Douglas. It was a lively time in Illinois. It was a time when great leaders were speaking and speaking out about slavery. And ultimately, Illinois was the place where Lincoln and Douglas argued out the whole issue of slavery for the American population, because their words were spread via newspapers, sent over the wires, and America read about what was happening in Illinois. So it was a Western town at that point, and it was absolutely happening in terms of arguing out the big issues for the United States.
There's a line about Illinois about 50 pages into the book. This is about, you know, it's about Anna in the mid-1850s, thinking about where she finds herself living. She's this immigrant, as we said earlier. You write, quote, "She found Central Illinois devoid of promise. Who would be inspired to greatness in this utterly flat place? It lacked beautiful mountains to uplift and remind one of higher things." It sort of reminds me of the way Charles Dickens described Illinois and the prairie in his American Notes. Do you think of Illinois that way?
You know that one. You know, actually, those were the thoughts of her mother. Anna was describing the thoughts of her mother. Her mother is the character. Genevieve Ferreira comes to the United States. She's come from a rather well-to-do family in Madeira, and she just looks around and says, "Look at this flat place. You know, there's no water. It's landlocked. There's no mountains to inspire you." But Anna is inspired. She's inspired by everything she encounters. I mean, she has a more open, innocent child's view. And also the mother is suffering greatly over a religious dilemma, which is that she's left her own home country to be with her husband and to follow a new faith, leaving Catholicism, pursuing the Presbyterian faith, and she has a religious crisis when she arrives in Springfield. She misses the Catholicism of her childhood. So the mother is struggling tremendously. She doesn't learn English as easily as her daughter does, and her daughter has to interpret for her. So her view of Illinois is quite different from Anna's, who is fascinated by everything her eyes fall upon. She loves the place.
Well, and one of the people she gets to know well is this reporter named Owen, who works for the Illinois State Journal. As people in Springfield will know, the State Journal Register used to be two pretty vehemently opposed newspapers, the Illinois State Journal and the Illinois State Register, on the issues of the day. And I mentioned at the start of our conversation, you were a journalist yourself. And I wonder how your experience in the world of reporting factored into this book and, you know, what you think of the reporting from the time. I've read some of those old accounts from the mid-19th century as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I think in my own work I have always been interested in getting it right. And that was in terms of nonfiction writing, in reporting a story, but I feel absolutely that way about fiction as well. I want to get it right. I feel like when I'm writing about real people, I feel an obligation to be fair in representing, to give that person a break until I find that their own actions or their own flaws cause them to make mistakes, and then I'm going to report those. But I feel that, you know, I feel it's important to represent what I find to be true and what newspapers were reporting now. The newspaper world then, and there are lots of newspapers that appear in my story because Anna's fascinated with them, and she learns English through the newspapers. The newspapers were the form of communication then. That was it. And they were everywhere. And there were a lot of newspapers available in Springfield, Illinois at that time. Lincoln actually bought a newspaper, a German language newspaper, in 1859 when he was going to run for the presidency. 1859 or 1860, he purchased this German newspaper. It was a political voice. Very often a newspaper was took political stands, and I mean, I know that Lincoln, at certain times in his early years, penned anonymous editorial pieces and was allowed to do so. I think that was just done. And in contrast, you know, the Register had everything to say that was wrong. I mean, they were expert at finding Lincoln's flaws and disagreeing with his philosophy. So they were really political tools, often.
Yeah. All right, let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is The 21st Show. We're speaking with Nancy Horan, who's the author of a historical novel centered around Springfield. It goes from before the Civil War into the early 1900s. It's called The House of Lincoln. Lincoln is a character in it, but it's really, as we've been talking about the people around him. And it also focuses on a lot of ideas that were vexing America at the time. Racism, feminism, the way we as a society view history. And that list goes on. But let's talk about some of those ideas. How do we see Anna, the main character, blazing her trail in a world that's been, and I guess still is, slow to give women a seat at the table?
Well, she does it very carefully, I think. I think she starts as a shy person who just comes out of her shell. But she has a close friendship with a young African-American girl named Cal. They befriend each other, on the steps of the Illinois Capitol building. When they are babysitting their brothers who were running around in the yard there, and their mothers are across the street working in an open-air market on Chicken Row. It was that north section of the city square. And in her growing independence, she is able to explore the town with her friend Cal. And she comes to see what Cal experiences on a daily basis as a young black child. She sees the discrimination that she bumps into, and Cal lets her know about it also. So her eyes begin to open. And, you know, when I was trying to figure out how an 11-year-old girl thinks, I couldn't remember anymore. One of my resources was a teacher of 11-year-old girls, and I took her to lunch and I said, "Tell me what 11-year-old girls care about." And she said one thing at first. She said, "Friendship. Friends are the most important thing for a girl at that age." And I thought, so she would keep secrets, perhaps from her parents, but in favor of sustaining her friendship with her friend Cal. And so a plot occurs relating to having secrets, both of them on each of their sides having secrets. And that is her first exposure. And as time goes on, and of course working for the Lincolns, she becomes aware of the growing dissension and growing division in the United States about slavery. And as it continues, you start to see the debates between Lincoln and Douglas through Anna's eyes. She attends those. So Anna's personal growth is definitely happening. She's starting to really have opinions of her own. At first, she doesn't, and her mentor, a woman who is helping put her through school, scolds her for not having enough opinions as a girl. The woman is an early feminist, and she's trying to shape Anna in a way. Anna has a couple of mentors, one of whom is Mary Lincoln. And so she is observing. So many of the observations in the book are from Anna's point of view. Anna's the primary point of view character. Mary Lincoln and Spencer Donegan are secondary points of view in the book. So we see her evolve over time, and she ultimately has a relationship with a young reporter who informs her even more. So she is a curious person. She's a bright woman. She does not strike off on some unrealistic career for a woman at that time that would have been highly uncharacteristic and unusual for a woman. But we see her open her mind tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Well, just a couple of minutes before we have to take a break, and there are obviously a lot that we're not going to have time to talk about today, but one of the biggest overarching themes in the book is racism and the way it permeates every aspect of our lives. We've talked before on our program about the early history of Illinois. It was supposed to be a free state, and yet slavery factored prominently into our history here.
Exactly.
And your book explores a lot of the injustices people who were black in Illinois faced, systemic and otherwise. Mm-hmm. A lot of us did not learn that history in our school time. Why do you think that is?
I think in the case of the so-called Springfield race riot, that was swept under the rug. That was ultimately a disgrace and an embarrassment. Not initially, I mean, but I mean, some of Springfield's finest citizens supported what happened, but many people did not, and they were embarrassed. And the nation criticized Springfield, Illinois, tremendously after that race riot happened. So perhaps because it was swept under the rug, we didn't know about it. But that's something we should have known about. And black laws is something we should have known about. Illinois had the most draconian, most extensive black laws in the North. That prevented, essentially designed to keep black people, free black people out of Illinois. And it had always been a part, since Illinois became a free state, entered the Union in 1818 as a free state, within 3 months the legislators had concocted black laws to limit the behavior of black citizens. They weren't considered citizens. So it was... It was a very complicated time. My eyes were opened by learning about the black laws, and certainly the race riot in Springfield, it was not what we learned. And so my simple view of the North, of Illinois being a northern state and on the right side of the Civil War and so forth, was informed by what I learned.
Yeah, and complicated. Research. Certainly informed and complicated.
Very complicated.
All right, we're going to take another break. We will continue with Nancy Horan. The book is The House of Lincoln. This is the 21st show. More to come after a short break. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with the author, Nancy Horan. Her latest historical novel is called The House of Lincoln. You might also remember her from some of her previous books, such as Under the Wide and Starry Skies and Loving Frank. Both of those were New York Times bestsellers. She's also worked as a journalist in Chicago, and she was born and raised in Springfield. She now lives in Washington State. 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation today. 800-222-9455. All right, you mentioned the Springfield Massacre, or as they're often known, the Springfield Race Riots. One of the climactic moments toward the end of the book is about that event and the hysteria that really takes hold as it plays out. I wonder, what is your hypothesis on how something like that ends up happening and having such a profound effect on people's lives, short-term and long-term?
Well, I think it was a surprise to a lot of people, but you know, I think a lot of us thought that the Civil War solved the issue of race or solved problems. It certainly ended slavery, but it didn't end racism. And racism is just something that has been a perpetual fact in the United States. It's part of the air almost. It was, and in Lincoln's time, and I think that I had a real understanding come to me about Lincoln and how he operated because of the racism in Illinois. And it is that Lincoln hated slavery, hated it, but he loved the Declaration of Independence, and he loved the Constitution, but there was a fly in the ointment with the Constitution, and that is, for him, that it was it didn't condemn slavery or call for getting rid of it. It was something that was going to require amendments eventually. Lincoln hated slavery. He didn't know how to get rid of it entirely. It was his dilemma. And he was criticized a lot for moving very slowly by abolitionists. But I came to understand what he was up against. And he knew the people very well of Illinois, and he knew people across the country. And he knew how deep the racism was, I think. And he had to find the lowest common denominator, the thing that people could agree on that would help them see that it had to stop, that the expansion of slavery could not continue into new territories. And he did that by really appealing to the moral and human qualities of the human being, and stressing the absurdity of having property in man, having regarding human beings as property, of being able to have a human being as property. He didn't rely on history and the history of slavery because it existed all through history. He wanted to just say, this is wrong. This is absolutely wrong. And he knew he had rightness on his side. So he said during the period when he was arguing with Douglas, I move slowly, but I don't go back. I don't go back, and I will never go faster than the people are able to go. And the people obviously were not very organized or of a mind to go very fast. They weren't. After those debates, they elected Stephen Douglas rather than Abraham Lincoln. there was racism that was a deep part of our culture. And it's just something that is a hard, intractable fact, you know, that you can't get around. And so I felt that ultimately Lincoln's approach paid off, that by going slow, he managed to pull people along with him. And ultimately, by the end, he was moving fast. By the time he did the Emancipation Proclamation, and then he started moving quickly, he changed his pace. But all along, he had to drag people along with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. Kay is calling on line 4 from Champaign. Kay, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you. I had an opportunity to interview David Herbert Donald, who wrote the biography, Lincoln. And you were talking about research, and I thought after I finished that book and interviewed him that there was nothing that I didn't learn, that there was anything more to learn about Lincoln. And this morning you've already mentioned some things that weren't covered in Mr. Donald's book. And I wondered what you thought of the book that he wrote.
Well, he is one of many experts on Lincoln, and he wrote a wonderful book. He has, you know, there are people today. There's Michael Burlingame is living in Springfield, Illinois, and is regarded as one of the finest scholars today on Abraham Lincoln. And there are other scholars in that same time in over the past 20, 30 years who have done remarkable work. And, you know, the interesting thing is that our attention to certain aspects of Lincoln's presidency or his ideas has a lot to do with where we are in our own political sphere at the moment. There's a great historical novelist, Hilary Mantel, who had a quote to the effect that history is not a bunch of facts that are collected inside a box. It's an ongoing dialogue between the present and the past. So when Donald was writing his book, there were undoubtedly focuses to his work that were perhaps slightly different than what the focus of Burlingame is, or the focus of John Meacham with his new book about Lincoln. There are so many books about Lincoln, and I think in my case, I am writing fiction, and I am interested in how these issues, how this history affects us now. You know, how does it come down to us now? How does it hit our ears? How does it feel to know these real things that happened in our past?
I appreciate that question, Kay. Thanks for calling in. Let's go now to line 1, where Ed is calling from Springfield. Ed, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thank you for inviting me in to the conversation. Wonderful. I'm going to grab the book as soon as I get out of a meeting in just a few minutes. But my points were a couple of them. My wife and I recently made the 8 station tour of the 1908 race riot. And these are the complaints I have with it. The first complaint I have deals really with history and writing, because on one of the panels, it states that between the 15th and the 16th, the mob took a cooling off period. They didn't cool off. If anything, they probably got a few belts under in them and planned their next murderous action. Those words, I'm not sure are appropriate. You may argue that they are, or someone may argue that they are, but that was my first point. And I'm sorry, you're breaking up a bit, so I can't.
No, no. So, and I think you also just wanted to mention that you thought the spots weren't being maintained.
physically. They're not being maintained. And
yeah.
If anything, I want to go back to the author's, one of the author's points, and that was that she said, you know, it was at the time it broiled up. But we didn't carry that on to through history with any respect. So respect shows that those stations would be maintained, flowers instead of weeds in the pots below. Okay.
All right, Ed. Thank you so much. I appreciate the
call.
Thank
you.
And
thank you.
Yeah, Nancy, I don't know if you want to respond to that. I'm reminded of that aphorism,
yeah.
Those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it.
Right, exactly. I thought those were very interesting comments. And, you know, I haven't observed the same thing. I haven't, but at the same time, I think that's an important thing to notice. And cooling off, perhaps, is probably the wrong language. I'd have to see it in context. But if it was cooling off before it went and to the second lynching site, I would not say that they cooled off. I would say that they continued their murderous rampage.
Yeah, very much so. Are we forgetting, and we're coming to the end of our time together. Thank you to everyone who called in today. But Nancy, I guess this will probably be our last question. Are we forgetting our past as a country? Are we doing a good job reckoning with it?
I think that we are forgetting. We need to know this information. And I've seen YouTube videos of college students who don't know what the Civil War was, who don't know why it was fought or who the people were in it. I think it's so essential in order to understand even the Black Lives Matter movement. How can you possibly, to understand democracy, how can you try to understand the preciousness of democracy if you don't know the history and about the history and the fight to maintain democracy? It's an idea. Democracy is an idea, and we need to be informed in order for it to continue and to thrive.
The book is called The House of Lincoln. It's out now from the publisher Sourcebooks Landmark. Nancy Horan, thank you so much for making the time to be with us on the 21st show.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure. Take care.
Listeners, we'd love to hear what you think about what we've been talking about, whether it's today or on any topic in the recent past. Let us know by emailing talk@21stshow.org. That is the address. Or you can leave a voicemail anytime. 217-321-2121 is the number for that. And you can call that anytime, day or night. It's a voicemail line. It won't wake us up. 217-321-2121. From time to time, we may share some of your responses on air. You can find that number and our email address and every other way to contact us on our website, which is 21stshow.org. Coming up on tomorrow's program, sometimes it can seem like scammers and fraudsters are everywhere, right? You have Theranos, FTX, we have political candidates who promise the world and deliver, let's just say, less than that sometimes. There are a pair of psychologists, including the University of Illinois' Daniel Simons, who say we don't have to fall for it. They're out with a new book this year. It's called Nobody's Fool. We're going to be talking about it tomorrow on the program. Simons is giving a big lecture later this week in Champaign-Urbana. We'll also have details on that. That's all coming up tomorrow on the 21st show. And that's all the time we have for our show today. Once again, visit our website, 21stshow.org. You can find our voicemail line, our email address, social media accounts, all the ways to contact us. It's at our website, 21stshow.org. You can also find links to our podcast there and past segments, or just look us up wherever you listen, Apple, Spotify. Search for The 21st Show. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Kennedy Vincent, and Jose Zepeda. Our intern is Nick Boyven. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.